Hello, my name is Pete, and I will be reading God's Word tonight. We're going to read John 17, verses 6 to 26. If you're following in the Bibles in your pews, that's on page 754. So John 17, starting at verse 6. I have revealed to you to those whom you gave me out of the world. They were yours, you gave them to me, and they have obeyed your word. Now they know that everything you have given me comes from you. For I gave them the word you gave me, and they accepted them. They knew with certainty that I came from you, and they believed that you sent me. I pray for them. I am not praying for the world, but for those you have given me, for they are yours. All I have is yours, and all you have is mine, and glory has come to me through them. I will remain in the world no longer, but they are still in the world, and I am coming to you. Holy Father, protect them by the power of your name, the name that you gave me, so that they may be one as we are one. While I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe by that name you gave me. None has been lost except the one doomed to destruction, so that scripture would be fulfilled. I am coming to you now, but I say these things while I am still in the world, so that they may have the full measure of my joy within them. I've given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they are not of the world any more than I am of the world. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. For them I sanctify myself, that they too may be truly sanctified. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you and I are one, and I in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them, and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them, even as I have loved me, as you have loved me. Father, I want those you have given me to be with me where I am and to see my glory, the glory you have given me because you loved me before the creation of the world. Righteous Father, though the world does not know, I know you, and they know that you have sent me. I have made you known to them and will continue to make you known in order that the love you have for me may be in them and that I myself may be in them.
Thanks, Pete. Hey, my name's Tom. If I haven't met you before, I'd love to chat to you afterwards. It's good to see a church building full. Sometimes people say that Christianity is kind of dead, had its ending at the end of last century. I don't really believe them. If you're in the university chat, the secularization thesis didn't really work out, and rooms like this prove it. We are going to be talking about unity tonight, John chapter 17. The reason we're talking about unity is because it was right in the middle of Jesus' prayer for us as he's heading to the cross. Look at John chapter 17, verse 20, 21. It'll come up on the screen. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you're in me and I am in you. This idea of unity is not new when we start in John chapter 17. It's actually a thread that runs the whole way through the Bible. And I would love to take you for the next 7 or 8 minutes on a left to right tour of the theme of unity throughout the entire Bible. We're going to skip a lot, but let's start in Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God makes people. I think we've got icons for all of these coming up as well. In the beginning, God makes people, and he is in a great relationship with them. They walk in the garden. They listen to their God. Everything is going well. And as a result of their quality vertical relationship, their horizontal relationship is good as well. What I mean is Adam and Eve were getting on really well in the garden. But at the fall, when Adam and Eve eat the apple for the first time, they get kicked out of the garden and everything starts to go wrong. It breaks, firstly, their unity with God. And secondly, as a result, it breaks their unity with each other. By Genesis chapter 4 already, you have the first recorded murder in the Bible, Cain and Abel. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where's your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" A little bit about me is before I took this job 2 years ago, we were living in Botany, which is where you go if you can't afford to live in Maroubra. But I spent a lot of time surfing at Maroubra, which is famous for the gang, the Bra Boys. So we'd all be in our wetsuits in the middle of winter. They'd paddle out in their board shorts because they wanted you to see the tattoo, which says, "My brother's keeper." Well, you know what's fascinating is that in the world, outside of the church, The desire for community often comes in even more strongly. But ultimately, it should be the church that is the place that's the strongest expression of unity. You keep coming with me on this tour from left to right, thinking about unity through the Bible. You get up to the Tower of Babel, Genesis 11. It's actually the Tower of Babel because that's where God made their speech mutually incomprehensible to each other. They were united, but they were united around a project that was not good. Their game plan was, let's build a tower to God. Let's make a name for ourselves. And God comes down on purpose and wrecks their unity. The point is that not all unity is good unity. Not unity for the sake of unity is not what we're on about. It is possible to unite towards evil ends. You keep coming to Exodus, right? And even God's people, after they've been rescued from slavery, do exactly the same thing. They unite over a project that is not good. Particularly, Moses is up on the mountain receiving what you would now call the Ten Commandments, and the people are at the bottom, and they get together, they unite, but their idea is, let's put all of our gold into a common pot, let's melt it down, let's make a false god. They make a little cow, and they start worshipping it. Not all unity is worth celebrating. And yet, if you come to the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, which is things like Psalms and Proverbs, we're in the top right-hand icon at this point, you get a celebration of unity properly expressed. An example of that is Psalm 133, verse 1. I wonder if you've ever had an experience like this. It says, "How good and pleasant it is when God's people live together in unity." Have you ever had that moment? If you've been a Christian for a little while, have you ever had a moment when you're like, yeah, I am united to these sisters. I am united to these brothers. And it is pleasant and it is good. You get a little taste of what it's meant to be like. Come to the cross with me if we skip a heck of a lot of the Old Testament. Come to the New Testament. Jesus' pinnacle of his ministry is dying on the cross. If you're kind of new to church and you're getting your head around all this stuff, Jesus dying on the cross is the main event. He dies on the cross for our sins in our place as our substitute. We reckon he actually came alive from the dead afterwards. He's ascended to heaven and one day he's coming back to judge the living and the dead. That includes you, no matter whether you are living or dead. And here's the thing. In the moment, at the pinnacle of his ministry, he's thinking about unity. John, right at the back end of the book of John, a little bit past our section here today, there's a bunch of people at the base of the cross. He's pinned up to the two wooden beams. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here's your son." And to that disciple, "Here's your mum." From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Jesus' heart is for unity even in the moment that he's experiencing crucifixion. Keep coming with me as we go left to right through the Bible about unity, because in Acts chapter 2, which we would now call Pentecost, the effects of Babel get flipped. At Babel, people had a bad idea to unite against God, and God scattered their languages. At Pentecost, the opposite happens. People have a message that is finally worth uniting over, and God makes it such that it's being declared in one language, but people from heaps of other languages start to understand it. God is uniting people together, crossing over linguistic and racial barriers, because there is a message worth sharing. And that message, as you keep going through the rest of the New Testament, unites the very people you would not ever expect to get in the same room, in that time, at that place. That's the Jews and the Gentiles. But so much of the New Testament, particularly Paul's letters, is concerned with the fact that the Jewish Christian believers needed to actually accept the Gentile Christian believers, because what God is doing is forming one new humankind out of the two groups. You get people in the room who you would never expect to cohabit a church service, and that's part of the beauty of the whole thing. Final stop on our whirlwind journey left to right through the Bible on unity is you get to Revelation chapter 7. This is the end game. This is where everything is going. And in 7:9 it says, "After this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb." Where we're going, the destination that we're on the way to, is united worship. People from everywhere coming together around the worship of the one true God. And so safe to say that unity is a pretty big deal all the way through the Bible. But tonight, we're in John chapter 17, and I would love to show you two things about unity as we listen into Jesus' prayer. Jesus is on his way to the cross. It's going to happen real soon. And we're listening into his prayer to the Father. We see what's on his heart and what it actually means to follow in the age-old tradition, in the age-old path of Jesus. I have a listen into John chapter 17, verse 14, because that's where we learn the first thing, which is that we are not united to the world. We're not united to the world. John chapter 17, verse 14, "I've given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they are not of the world any more than I am of the world." 15 and 16, next slide. "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it." See, Jesus seems to reckon that if you are a follower of Jesus, you are not of the world. You might be in the world, but you are not of the world. You are different to the people around you who don't know their God. To flesh that out a bit, can I show you a quote from a really old school theologian? This is John Stott. He said this, and by the way, this has an assumption of an Anglo-Saxon background, which is not true for all of us. So do the translation. He says, "Western secularism is to the Christian just as much a foreign culture as Islam or Hinduism." A bunch of us have been to Japan recently, lots of trips. Maybe you've been to Thailand before, something like that. Maybe you've been to somewhere even more foreign to my experience than both of those places. You get off the plane and you feel like, gee, I'm different from the people here. Like, this is a new thing for me. It's supposed to feel like that living in Sydney. If you had to draw a box around kind of the standard thing that people in Sydney are being influenced by, the standard way of thinking, it's called Western secularism. And we think differently in the way of Jesus from Western secularism. Think about this. We don't believe that there's only one life, and so you've got to suck all of the experiences out of it, otherwise you've missed out. Because we know there's something better coming. And it means you can just chill in your life and you can actually enjoy what's going on instead of feeling like you're missing out the whole time. We don't believe that the ultimate code of ethics is to do whatever you feel like as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. Because we know that there's a God who has a much higher vision for morality than just that very basic code. We are so different from Western secularism. If you will inhabit the teaching of the scriptures and let the way of Jesus wash over you. Now, that was a pretty intense opening. Can we take a breather? The other day on a Saturday, my wife and my little daughter and I, we went on a train and we went to Milsons Point. We wanted to do a day where we were tourists in our own city. So we got on the train, we kind of got off, and there's a good little coffee shop underneath the Milsons Point station. And then we kind of walked down to Luna Park and this ferry pulled in, and we were like, hey, why not? So we got on the ferry, went across to Circular Quay. On the way into Circular Quay, you look to the right and you can see the rocks. There was like a little market going on. So we threw our daughter in the pram, kind of pushed her around. She fell asleep. We were like, this is good. So we walked all the way around the foreshore to Barangaroo. If you're working in Barangaroo, you know Shortstop Donuts and North Sandwiches that are big enough to feed the whole family. If you know, you know. And it was just a great day. We had a good time. I was like, this is great. I feel like a tourist in my own city. And here's the thing. If you are deeply living in the truths of Jesus, and if you're seeking to grow in that, every day you are a tourist here. You don't belong. You might know heaps of people. You might have been born here. You might have just got like some job at Wynyard Station and you're feeling like, hey, I feel like I know the buildings around. I know my way around this city now. But you don't belong to it. You are not of the world, even though you are in it. Now have a think about verse 18 with me. We'll pull it up on the screen. Because, and I realize I've skipped a little bit, but we can roll with it. In verse 18, you get the corrective to where a lot of us might naturally go. You say, great, I'm not meant to be of the world. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pull back. I'm going to go to my mate's farm. I'm going to book some kind of monastic retreat thing. I'm going to like just pull right back from all of these potentially negative influences all around me. I'm going to separate from the world. But verse 18 changes our mind about that course of action as well, because Jesus says, as you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. Imagine with me kind of a one side and the other side. On the one side, you could have just completely withdrawing from the world, but verse 18 doesn't let you do that. On the other side, you could say, okay, well, let's just fit right in. Let's just be like everyone else. Let's just totally assimilate into the world around us. But the rest of what we've studied so far doesn't allow that. So what is the posture of a Christian towards the world around us? The answer is ambassador. That seems to be one of the most helpful biblical categories for what you are living in Sydney right now, is you're meant to be a political ambassador. You know what they do, right? Like they live in the country, but they are so different from that country. They have meaningful relationships and stuff to be doing. And yet you look at them, you observe their way of life, and you think, whoa, they're really, really different. We're not meant to retreat, but we're also not meant to assimilate. We're supposed to be like ambassadors here in this world. So I said at the start, I just want to tell you two things from John 17. That was the first one. You're halfway. Well done. We are not united to the world, but we are united to each other. And can I just pause there for just a second? Because I'm aware that some of us in the room are thinking, hey, you're kind of pushing me out here. You're trying to exclude me because I'm not sure where I'm at with the whole Jesus thing yet. So are you saying that I can't be part of this? Here's the thing. Currently, you are ununited, is that the word, from God. But the invitation is that you are so welcome to connect to the God who made you and thereby to be welcomed into this community, some other church community, whatever you choose. The arms of God and hopefully the arms of the Christian community are wide open because Jesus' heart to the world is full of love. And so, even though we're not united to the world, we are different, we are united to each other. If you've got a Bible in front of you, have a look at verse 20 and 21. Jesus says, my prayer is not for them alone. Just pause there for a second. So far, he has been talking specifically to the 11 disciples in front of him. There were 12. One of them kind of gave it all up for some money. And so there's 11 left. And he's saying about them in all the verses kind of before verse 20. But in verse 20, he says, my prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. That's us. Jesus knew that something like 2,000 years after his time in the Middle East, there would be communities of people on the other side of the world, on the other side of time, who gather to sing his praises. He knew that you'd be sitting here. He knew that all of this was going to go down, and he prays for us. Here's what he prays. Pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. That all of them may be one. All of them would be one, Father, just as you are in me and I'm in you. Can I show you a couple of aspects of this prayer that really matter? The first one is that our unity, our oneness, is a unity around something. Specifically, it's a unity around their message. Here's the thing. If you're a Christian here today, you believe because you have adopted and accepted the message that originally was put forward by Jesus' 11 remaining disciples. You stand in that age-old tradition. You have accepted that message. We do not have a unity that is based around unity. Like, we are not just like, yeah, unity sounds good, let's ignore true things and let's just get together because it feels nice. This is unity around substance. This is unity around truth. This is unity, in the language of the text, around their message. And all of this leads us to ask those kind of really detailed, really worthwhile questions that go something like this. Hey, my friend over here says they're a Christian, but they believe some kind of different stuff to me. Are we united? What's the go? I'll give you a framework to have these chats in. I won't try and fill it all in for you, but I'll give you something that's worth starting the conversation. Some things seem to be closed-hand issues when you study the Bible closely, and some are open-hand issues. This seems to be the way of thought that Paul the Apostle used when he was writing a lot of his letters. Some things he is not discussing. They are not up for a chat. These things are the core of what we believe. Other things he thinks, hey, I think this, but if you think that, that's cool. We can all still be in community. I'll give you an example. It seems to be that the physical, real, non-cute metaphor version of the resurrection is a closed-hand issue. We actually reckon Jesus rose from the dead. I realize that sounds nuts, but that is core to what we believe. If you call yourself a Christian and you think, nah, Jesus didn't actually rise again from the dead, I have some pretty serious questions, because that is a closed-hand issue when you read through the scriptures. But there are open-hand issues. There are lots of things in the scriptures where you think, hey, we can study the Bible together and have a really good, meaningful chat that goes back and forth, and we actually ask each other some probing questions, but maybe in the end we come to different conclusions, and that's okay. An example of that would be like the book of Revelation, right? There are lots of non-stupid ways to read the book of Revelation. And you ask somebody about them and you say, oh, I can kind of see where you're coming from there. Now, it is possible that you might be sitting here today having absolutely no idea about the following words. It is also possible that you are deep in the chat around amillennialism, postmillennialism, premillennialism, and all the associated adjectives that make you sound even smarter and more nuanced than that. Here's the thing. We can call that an open hand issue. And you can believe a bunch of different things about that. And we can have community, we can have unity, we can have fellowship together. Some things are open-hand issues and some things are closed-hand issues. But what you can't say is that content doesn't matter, because our unity ultimately is unity around their message. Can I show you the second thing in Jesus' prayer that's really worth noticing, which is that our unity is meant to be based around the Trinity. It's meant to be a reflection of the Trinity. If you've ever thought about it like this before, tri-unity, Trinity, that's what the word is. Have a look at the little circle phrase up on the screen. He says that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. Now, we 100% believe in the Holy Spirit. He's just not super prominent in this particular moment. So I'm going to talk mostly about the Father and mostly about the Son. Here's the thing. People who have thoughtfully studied the scriptures for many, many years usually end up saying something like this about the nature of the Godhead. They say, there is only one God, and is also true that there are three persons to the Godhead. the Father and the Son and the Spirit are not each other, and yet it is also true that there is only one God. And you would be right in saying, sorry, what? That's a little bit confusing. And I'm okay with that. What about you? Like when we come to God, I'm okay with the idea that some things take a little bit of thought. And if everything was understandable in 3 seconds, I'd ask if this is just a human version of God instead of the real deal. One God, three persons. So in this prayer, Jesus seems to think that the Father is not the Son and the Son is not the Father, and yet the two are so close that the appropriate way to describe that relationship is the word in. Did you catch that? Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, and that's what our unity is supposed to be like. We believe in a unified Godhead, and so we are meant to be, Jesus is praying for us to be a unified people. Can I point out a third thing? Final one. May they also be in us that the world may believe that you have sent me. There's something observable about this unity that cuts through. You can watch all the YouTube debates back and forth you want. You can have all the late 2 a.m. chats that you want. But when you see Christians united, something special happens. One of the people up here singing tonight is Steph. Steph's just started a traineeship at church, and Steph talks about the first moment that she came to church. She says nothing about the preaching, and I take no offense. She says the singing, and she's not just talking about Owen up here shredding it with lots of skill. She says the singing from the people who were standing, like the regular people, that was what really struck me, because they're all singing this one song. And so after we're done with my kind of chat, we're going to sing a song together that's like based off a creed, and in so doing we're going to unite with people from thousands of years in the past. We're going to unite with people all over the globe in the message that we all share. There is something beautiful about Christian unity when it's lived out properly, which is why it's so jarring when you see the opposite. Consider this quote from really old school theologian Thomas Manton. He says this: divisions in the church breed atheism in the world. Have you ever experienced that? If you're kind of new to church and you're still thinking about the things of faith, is it true that the biggest barrier to having faith is that the other people you know who have faith aren't actually that great? Divisions in the church breed atheism in the world. Can I say that in the positive? Unity in the church breeds belief in the world. One of Jesus' big mission strategies is the unity of his people. And so, I said that I just wanted to point out two things from John chapter 17. Firstly, we're not united to the world. Secondly, we are united to each other. And is it okay if we start moving towards a close? I'd love to say some more specific stuff to us in this time, in this place. Number one, unity across generations. Last week, our senior minister Nigel was up here. He showed us a graphic that looked a little bit like this. And he said there's like 7 generations trying to cohabit Australia right now, and there's a lot of misunderstanding between the generations. In a group like this, the primary form that that takes is like angst against boomers, right? And you go, they broke the housing market. They probably broke the global like environment. They did lots of things wrong. They also kind of, as a result of that, we have some cool tech. But like pros and cons. But I have a lot of angst towards the boomers, right? That's the classic form that this comes out from this kind of room. That's probably true, in all honesty. And yet, what do we do with people who we're a little bit grumpy about because they haven't lived the way we want if they're also followers of Jesus? Are we led by following the culture and joining in the angst club? Or when we meet an older, faithful Christian, is there something deeper than just my experience of the housing market? I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. Let's keep going. Number two, let's talk about something more controversial. Let's talk about church music, right? Here's the thing. When you go around the world, there's like two things that bind people together. The first one is that food. You get people around a table and suddenly everyone's got a smile on their face. The second one, cultural festivals are often dominated by music. Music worldwide is a thing that is meant to unite. And then you come into the church and you go, I like this music, you like that music, you sit there, I'll go to that service, it's all very different. And we let our personal Spotify playlists dictate the way we get together. Church ultimately is bigger than my musical preference. Our unity is worth so much more than the kind of music that I'm personally most excited about. Can I give you a third and final one? This is where we're going. I want to talk about unity when I don't know everyone in the room. We're getting close to a finish. Have you had this experience recently at the end of the church service, right? Arlene or Ben, they say amen, and then you stand up or you look around and you go, I don't feel like I know many people. Beautiful mullets. Beautiful. Sitting in the same spot as last week too. Well done. You look around and you're like, I know like some of the people here, but I really feel like I don't know many people at all. And that's a really normal thing to feel. There's this sociologist called Robert Dunbar. He came up with this number around about 150 just through watching people interact. And he said, something weird happens at approximately the gathering size of 150 people. This is not just a church thing. This is a human thing. He says, when the gathering is smaller than 150 people, it is possible, if you try, to actually have meaningful relationships with just about everyone else in that group. But once you get over 150, that is a burden that no one can bear. So here's the thing. There's way more than 150 people in the room right now. You do not have to know everyone else's name. You can release yourself of that burden. At the same time, it would be a tragedy if we said, guys, it doesn't matter about the other people sitting around me in this building. I'm just here to kind of sing some songs, feel good, and then go home. I'm just here for kind of participation, and then I'm going to leave, because this is meant to be a community. It would be a tragedy if somebody came and nobody talked to them. It would be a tragedy for people to feel unnecessarily kind of on the outer. Not everyone's going to be best mates with everyone, and that's totally normal and okay. But we've got to have the heart that says that I want the person on the outside to feel known. So how about we say something like this? How about we go with a strategy where we say, not everyone knows everyone, but everyone is known. Can I say that again? Not everyone knows everyone, but everyone is known. This is partially why we get so excited about growth groups, because that's a space where everyone is known. This is partially why we get so excited about serving in a team together, because that is where you get known. And on top of that, what are we actually united by? We're united by our faith, not just by the fact that you like the same stuff or in the same version of life as the people around you. So we're moving to a finish. Can I give you some examples of how this might play out in your life very soon? First one, you get a new job, right? You catch your train, you get off the train, you go into the new office, you work out who your manager is, who you're sitting with, but you're also asking, who are my lunch people? Who am I going on coffee breaks with? Who am I united with in this new office? And the answer is that even before you know their name, the closest unity you can share with anyone in that office is that they are also united to Christ. He's their big brother, he's your big brother. That makes you guys sisters and brothers. Number two, imagine you get on a plane and instead of just locking in with your headphones, you decide you're going to talk to the person next to you. You're trying to work out, do I share anything in common with this person? The greatest thing that you can share with a total stranger is your faith in Jesus. Third and final one, you got a new growth group this year and you're thinking, gee, I kind of liked the people in my growth group last year better. I felt like by the end of the year, we were really well gelled. Here's the thing, you are united by faith more than by the year's worth of experience. You are united by faith even when the person on the other side of the circle isn't really that much like you. Ben, do you guys want to come up? We're about to sing a song that is like based off a creed, which is just a bunch of words that people have been signing up to for many, many years, but we turned it into a song. And there's something beautiful about giving one voice to that message, joining in the song. If you're kind of new to the whole faith thing, this might actually be the first time that you choose to join in yourself. Let me finish with the words of Jesus. John chapter 17, verse 20. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you're in me and I am in you. And everyone said together in a big tone of unity,